This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Carolina Panthers are on a remarkable roll. They are 9-0 on the season with the most consecutive wins ever. That puts us among the best NFL teams in the nation. How did this happen? How long can it continue? We talk about that with the Charlotte Observer, Scott Fowler, and the radio voice of the Carolina Panthers, Mick Mixon, later in the program. But before we delve into the inner workings of our winning team, let's explore the inner workings of our own bodies. A few years ago, Discovery Place played host to a remarkable exhibit called Body Worlds. It put on display real human bodies, plasticized in such a way that we could see ourselves from the inside out. The first exhibit so impressed Jamie Decker that she pursued a career in anatomy and physiology. That pursuit led her all the way to Germany, where she became the first American intern at the, I hope I say this correctly, the Plastinarium, where Body Worlds was created. Well, now she's back home and working as Discovery Place Project Specialist for Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life, and a faculty instructor of anatomy and physiology at Central Piedmont Community College, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome. A new Body Worlds exhibit is about to open. It will open on Saturday, in fact, at Discovery Place. Catherine Wilson-Horn is president and CEO of the museum, and she, too, is here. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
And Dr. Angelina Wally, creative and conceptual designer of Gunther von Hagen's Body Worlds exhibitions and director of the Institute for Plastination in Heidelberg, Germany, is also here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. The original Body Worlds exhibit was the most visited traveling exhibit, I think, in the world. 40 million people saw it all over the world in more than 90 cities across this country, and it broke Discovery Place's records for attendance in 2007. What's at work here? Do you understand what the fascination is here?
Well, I absolutely do, Mike. It is about ourselves and bringing science to life by better understanding how our bodies work and what's inside of all of us. It is the one thing that unites people of all races and genders in recognizing that we all are made of this remarkable structure inside our skin, and it brings science to life. Mm-hmm. It helps youth like Jamie see that they have a future in a medical field and to discover that science belongs to all of them. And so we felt, as we've committed to helping children and youth see their futures, we felt how better to do that than to bring a new edition of the Body Worlds exhibition back to Charlotte. It's been a generation since we last saw it, and now we have a new set of students and residents of the community who can all enjoy this very special treasure.
Now, you weren't here for the first time it came through because I think you were in Columbia.
I was.
You just recently taken over in the last several years at Discovery Place. So you weren't here for some of the discussion. We did a program on this when it first came through, and it was a little controversial because these are human bodies. These are not fake things that you're looking at. These are human beings that have they've passed on. They've mm-hmm. donated their bodies to this effort, and they are on full display, and I mean full display. And
That's
there
right.
was some discussion about all of this. Obviously, the record-setting attendance dispelled all of that.
Well, I think that it's the importance of the topic that causes us to think about how you bring critical issues to a community so that it makes museums like Discovery Place more relevant to a community discussion about obesity prevention and about the critical factors that affect human health and our bodies as we age. But it is also about how we are able to educate the community in those tough topics. Mm-hmm. You'll also remember we did a major groundbreaking exhibition on race very early on. And I think Discovery Place has built our reputation on being able to recognize what Charlotte needs to discover at the appropriate time.
So Jamie Decker, you're the project specialist for this at Discovery Place, and you're kind of overseeing this particular exhibit.
Sure.
You found this exhibit the first time around to be life-changing.
Absolutely.
How old were you then?
I was 18 years old.
What about it was life-changing for you?
Well, it was the first time I'd seen anything like that.
Yeah.
At a museum, of course. My sister and I visited it together, and I remember seeing Gunther von Hagens and wondering, who is this guy? How did he come up with this? There's got to be people behind the scenes creating the exhibition, creating the dissections, coming up with the concept. So I started researching, and it took me years to find out who was doing it. So in 2011, I found a Plastination conference in Toledo, Ohio, made my way to Toledo, and Dr. Gunther von Hagens happened to be at that conference.
In the interim, between the time you saw this exhibit and the time you went to the Plastination conference, you went to school, obviously, went to college.
I did.
I'm told that you went to mortuary school.
That's
as
correct.
Well.
Yep.
I've never met anybody, I don't think, who's gone to mortuary school. And then you got an invitation to be an intern at the Plastinarium,
correct,
which is where they do this. Let me bring Dr. Angelina Wally into this conversation. We'll come back to you in a second, sure. Jamie. But the fact that there was a Plastination conference in Toledo, Ohio, and the fact that Gunther von Hagen kind of helped, maybe he did create this process. What's outside of your exhibit? What is the interest in plastination?
Well, actually, my husband, Gunther von Hagens, he's the inventor of the technology. Okay. He invented it back in 1978. And ever since, he spent his entire professional career to make it what it is today. And plastination was invented and further developed to help facilitating teaching anatomy, basically at medical schools, universities. It was not necessarily meant to teach the public.
Right.
And it was only in 1995 when we first had our first exhibition in Japan, when we were invited by the Japanese Anatomical Society that had their 100th anniversary back then. And they had a public exhibition organized at the Tokyo National Science Museum, and they invited us to be part of that. And it was such a unique experience to see lay people interacting with our exhibit. They were so moved, particularly in Japan. You know, the Japanese society, they are so self-controlled. At the Western, you hardly recognize or have an idea what they have in their minds. But inside the exhibition, it was as if all these masks have fallen down. You saw really deeply moved people. And one day we experienced a young woman, for instance. She cried. And she finally said, you know, I attempted suicide 3 times in my life. I always felt useless, nothing worth. But now, seeing these beautiful specimens, I realize I have something very wonderful, something very important inside me, and I promise I will never do that again. And later at that moment, we understood this is something important to lay people. We have to continue with the idea to bring it to the public.
Mm.
And the rest is history.
And you had not quite a severe experience, but you had a similar experience because it did lead you down your professional path.
Absolutely.
Jamie, so you went to mortuary school, you went to this exhibit in Toledo, this conference in Toledo, and then you ended up going to work as an intern for the people that do the plastinization. What did you learn that you didn't think you would learn being on the other side of it?
Oh, so much. I think it's an experience unmatched to anything that I would have had in traditional education in the United States.
How so?
I was able to work one-on-one with multidisciplinary specialists from all over the world who were working or studying or maybe doing a sabbatical in Germany using the specimens. So I particularly worked in the dissection area, which is one of the first processes in plastination before the finalized product. So I got to see so many different bodies and so many different anomalies and hear from other professions of how it kind of enhances their learning. And that's something even in medical school. I formerly worked at a medical university as well.
How does it enhance a professional's learning? Because we've seen the drawings of the anatomical drawings that are in the textbooks for doctors. We've seen doctors perform on film, at least, dissections of the human body. We have seen kind of reconstruction with artificial elements of bone and muscle and blood vessels put together on a legitimate plastic thing. But these are human bodies. So what does this teach you that the plastic version, the fake version, doesn't?
I think that's very natural. We humans tend to pay more attention, be more hit by things that are real, that are authentic. For instance, a live interview will draw a lot more attention rather than a canned version or a soccer game. You can watch soccer on TV a lot better. You can a lot closer to the football players, but you may prefer to go to the stadium where you also feel the atmosphere. And it's very similar to our exhibition, to see and feel that this is real. It's an entire different experience.
And this is a different experience than the last time Body Worlds was here.
It is. This is an exhibition that takes the theme of the cycle of life. So truly from the development of a fetus into a baby, and also looking at how we age. And I think one of the remarkable things about this exhibition is it still has all of the beauty and the sense of wonder about the human anatomy and what these bodies do and the interrelationship of the skeletal system and the organs and the muscular system. But in fact, it now shows us and it honors the way in which we mature in our human bodies.
How does it do that? How are you able to achieve that?
Well, of course, we cannot always show everything as we would want because most of our donors, they die, fortunately, at old age. But of course, we can address a lot of issues inside the exhibition that explains how we mature and that is very important to me as a curator, to make people understand that the human body is not just a divine gift or bounty of nature. It is a result of our lifestyles, and whatever we do to it, it matters.
Let me ask you this then, because I know that we age on the outside. You can look at a person, you can gauge in many cases how old they are, and you can even see maybe what kind of life experiences they've had, because if you had a particularly hard life, that tends to show up on your face. And of course, we get arthritis and we have problems with our bodies as we get older. Does that show on the inside as well as the outside?
Exactly. Of course, we age also from the inside, and as a layperson, you are just not trained
to see it.
But when you're entrained in anatomy and pathology, you may.
And one of the things that this exhibit does show is because you have not only full, complete human bodies, you have specimens of organs, and you show healthy organs next to those that have either been diseased or been abused and misused by the person when they were alive. And you can clearly see the impact of things like what? Smoking? What else?
You can see what cancer looks like, arteriosclerosis, heart infarction, all these things that you are confronted nowadays so often, maybe in your family or you read about it, hear about it. And here you can really see what it is, what it looks like, and what causes it.
And is the hope that by seeing that you'll alter your behavior?
Absolutely.
Quickly.
I think that the obesity is one of the most important invisible things that you see through the exhibition.
Let's stop there. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC's Gilling School of Global Public Health, offering GoMPH, the Global Online Master of Public Health program. More at sph.unc.edu/GOMPH1. And by Historic South End, celebrating this holiday season during Small Business Saturday, November 28th, over 200 shops offering unique gifts for all on that holiday shopping list. Details at historicsouthend.com. Few find it easy to transition from school to the adult world, but for people who have high-functioning autism and Asperger's syndrome, it can be a real challenge. Not only are these folks facing a major life transition, some or much of the help they've relied on as children begins to drop away at the exact same time. So we hear about one program in our area designed to help. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the hunt continues for those behind the Paris attacks. A growing number of regional and world powers agree on the need to unite against ISIS. Prospects for an international coalition and strategies being considered.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Body Worlds, the new exhibit that will be opening at Discovery Place on Saturday and running through May 1st at Discovery Place. And in a few minutes, we'll be talking about the Carolina Panthers' undefeated 9-0 season and try to figure out why, how, and how much longer this can continue. We were talking about some of the things that you can learn in this exhibit, particularly when you look at how we use ourselves, our bodies, through life. And Catherine, you have said that you hope that visitors will gain new perspective on their body's capabilities and how everyday life choices impact overall health and our future selves.
That's right, Mike.
How does this exhibit accomplish that?
Well, I think it brings us face to face with our own mortality and to recognize that we can't just wait until we're 60 years old and suddenly decide that we can undo all of the abuses that
now
we
you
have
tell
put.
Me.
I know. Well, I'm there nearly too. And it's very interesting to think about the choices that you would make. But the exhibition also includes a number of things like a knee replacement joint so that you actually can see what that prosthesis looks like in a leg. And it gives people a chance to be coming to their own conclusions about the choices that we would make as individuals. One of the things that we are doing throughout the exhibition is that each month we will be taking a different topic, whether it be health disease or healthy choices, which is the topic for January as we all make New Year's resolutions. Mm-hmm. And I would say 75% of New Year's resolutions all deal with how we improve our lives.
Well, getting back to the fact that we age from the inside as well as the outside, and that when the choices that we make, whether or not to exercise, whether we eat too much sugar or too much fat, or whether we smoke or not, whether we take drugs, etc., that impacts our inner selves. If we did those things and it truly affected, like if we took a drag on a cigarette and suddenly our face turned black or turned, I don't know, orange or something like that, or the wrinkles just like that happened, we wouldn't do it, would we?
I would say so, yes. The thing is, when we're young and our bodies, fortunately enough, they forgive quite a bit.
Yeah.
But if you all of a sudden fail, get your first heart infarction, then it may be too late for you to shift your lifestyle.
For those people who did not see the first exhibit, Body Worlds, or may even be completely unaware that this kind of thing exists in the world, let's talk about what these are. These are real human bodies. We've talked about this a little bit, but I want that to sink in for people. You're looking at real human bodies. Who are the people who donated themselves to this, and why did they do it?
These are people like you and me, from all ages, from all different societies. Most of them are Germans because our laboratories are located there, but we also have around 1,500 donors in the U.S. and even 25 from the Charlotte area. And the vast majority of our donors decided to become a donor after seeing the exhibition, mm-hmm. after feeling so inspired and being convinced that this is important to also help future generations to get a better understanding of their bodily functions.
Some people may find this macabre. Others may find it immoral. Why isn't it?
I think we honor the humans that are in the exhibition. They are treated as with respect for the human body in a way that is both an art form and a scientific instrument for learning. And for decades, physicians in training in med schools have worked in a gross anatomy lab. And that has been one of the things that has set people in the medical professional apart. But this is the opportunity for every man to understand better about the human body in ways that we can't replicate in movies and television series and even on the internet in the way that you see it in a life size.
And in fact, did you not have theologians and ethicists and academics and medical people all conduct a kind of review of this process and these exhibits and in response to some of the criticism that you were getting for this?
In fact, many museums have chosen to have an ethical report done before the exhibition was hosted. And all of these ethical reports came to the conclusion that the exhibition is absolutely not only suitable for the museum's community, but also that the surroundings are handled with utmost ethical care.
You've designed this exhibit, and you've juxtaposed a lot of things. You've juxtaposed the what we're looking at with the ruminations about life and death from people like Shakespeare and Nietzsche and Goethe, among others, and you've put healthy organs next to diseased organs so that we can see what happens to ourselves when we misuse ourselves or when disease takes us to certain places. But talk to me about the process of plastinization, the two of you, if I'm saying that correct.
Plastination is correct, too.
Say it again.
Plastination.
Talk to me about the process. I decide to donate my body. The light goes out. I'm ready to be used. What happens next?
Well, the first thing is we have to stop decay. That is done by a formaldehyde injection, as any anatomist would do. And then we have all the time we need to apply the anatomical dissections to take off the skin, show all the muscles and nerves and arteries, whatever we want or need to show. And then, only then, the plastination process starts. And plastination, to put it simple, is a vacuum process that allows us to exchange the tissue water against a polymer like silicone rubber or epoxy resin, polyester resin.
And so you pull the water out.
Exactly.
And replace it with?
Yes. And you cannot do that directly because the polymer would not mix with water.
Mm-hmm.
So you need an intermediary step, meaning you need to dehydrate by means of a volatile solvent like acetone. We just put the specimen, the wet specimen, into the solvent, leave it to stay, and the chemical gradient would take out the water and push in the acetone as its replacement.
Now, you're a medical doctor.
Yes.
You could have become a medical doctor. You kind of approached that yourself. Why devote yourself to this as opposed to being a medical doctor? Jamie?
For me, as I've said before, that would be like asking me why I didn't become a mechanic. I'm not interested in becoming a doctor. You know, I'm interested in the ways that people learn anatomy, the way that these people learn medicine, and cadavers have historically been used for thousands and thousands of years to create the most accurate medical texts, to create the most beautiful art. So what's being done in plastination isn't new as far as using human bodies to learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the best method for doing it.
Because these are human beings, and because these are human beings in the wherewithal, in many cases, what age groups do you recommend come to this exhibit?
You know, it's really suitable for all ages. It's a serious exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is likely to be better attended by middle years in the elementary schools and older in terms of audiences.
But let's be clear, these people are naked.
These people are without their skin.
Right.
It's different than being walking around without your clothes on.
Okay.
Okay, because it's focused on the muscles and the bones and the organs in ways that you certainly see in textbooks and in audiovisuals in a classroom or a laboratory, but you rarely see it as a whole human like you do in this exhibition.
body worlds and the cycle of life. And this is because it's called the cycle of life because you're seeing people at various stages of aging, from conception right on through old age. It's the work of Gunther von Hagen and also Dr. Angelina Wally, who's the creative and conceptual designer of this exhibit, Jamie Decker, project specialist for body worlds at Discovery Place, and Catherine Wilson Horn, the president and CEO of Discovery Place. The exhibit opens Saturday and runs through May 1st of 2016. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, the Carolina Panthers are breaking records and making history. So far this NFL season, they are 9-0, making them among the most successful teams in the National Football League. There are still a lot of games left this season, so the question becomes, how long can the Panthers sustain this winning record, this undefeated season? The other question is, what happened between last season and this one to make this happen? Well, for a little insight on that and on the upcoming games, which include matchups against the New York Giants, the New England Patriots, and this week's game against the Washington Redskins. Did I say the Falcons? I don't think I did, but we play them twice. We've invited some experts. Scott Fowler is here from the Charlotte Observer, and the radio voice of the Panthers, Mick Mixon, is also in our broadcast booth, high overlooking 7th Street, high on high, up here in Spirit Square. Welcome to the program. Welcome back.
I don't like the way the Plastination guests are looking at me on their way out the door.
You are a definite candidate. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. Did either of you, since you follow this for your livelihoods, did either of you anticipate this kind of a season?
No, I definitely did not. I'll be first to admit I didn't think they would do anything like this, and I've been around them since the beginning, but sports are a funny thing, you know, momentum and confidence, and then they've had well, a lot of things we can talk about go right, but they also have more talent than I thought they had, honestly. Yeah. If a couple of guys have emerged that I was not expecting to emerge, it's been an incredible run.
Same question. Is it a surprise to you? Is it a surprise to the team?
No, it's not a surprise to me, and it's not a surprise to the team, Mikey. I think, like Scott was alluding to, the NFL, every team has so many good players. It's not like college where you're pretty sure that LSU is not going to lose to Louisiana Lafayette on a particular Saturday. But on Sundays, everything changes because every team has 6, 8, 10 guys that could start for the other team. So in the NFL, if you don't play well, you're going to lose, even if it's a team that hasn't won yet midseason.
Well, what changed? Because we had a tough time last season until toward the end when we had a winning streak, which carried us into this season. What changed?
I'll tell you exactly what changed is not really that much, because the taproot of cohesiveness that this team is nourished by actually probably started before last year, but it started to get national attention last year when the Panthers start 2-0, then 2-2, then 3-2, and then go 3-8-1. But get up off the deck from that and go to the playoffs with so many factors. Reporters with their notepads like Scott Fowler does, asking inquisitive questions, tugging at the team. NFL teams get covered so tenaciously that if there's any divisiveness, if the offense is mad at the defense, if this player's not working hard enough, if these coaches don't have the leadership traction in the locker room they should have, it'll come out. But the Panthers stayed together, stayed united in their belief, and so going to minicamp, OTAs, and Scott to Camp Wofford this year, don't you think the Panthers knew they were good? They knew they couldn't have predicted 9-0, but they knew this was a good football.
Well, they did know they were good. I agree with you there. And we saw, like you're saying, they won 5 of their last 6 last year, Mike. So they were coming in pretty hot. But 9-0, I mean, that just doesn't happen very often in the NFL. I mean, 7-2, 8-1, you know, that's 9-0 is pretty extraordinary.
Is that because of the season of the teams they faced thus far this season? Has it been an easy road so far for them, or would this have happened if they'd played the Patriots already?
Well,
they're
9-0 as well. No, I don't think it's really the schedule. I mean, originally you could maybe say that the first 3 or 4 games, those teams weren't very good, but they went through a murderer's row over the last month. And it's become now that, you know, they're just one of the best 3, maybe one of the best 2 teams in the league right now.
You say the team, both of you have said that the team knows that it's good, and they knew they were good before the season started. Did the rest of the teams know that we were good? Did they perhaps come in here or come into the stadiums in which they played thinking, well, it's the Panthers?
Maybe, but I think the NFL, in that sort of fraternity of NFL players, the other teams know. I mean, they know Cam Newton isn't catching anybody by surprise. Luke Kuechly's not catching anybody by surprise. Now, maybe some second-page stories below the fold.
Well, maybe Josh Norman
would be one. Kawan Short. K.K. Short would be another. Yeah.
Well, you say they know, but then the commentator – forgive me, Mick, but the commentator on television last Sunday – sorry.
Hello, testing. Is this on? Did you say the commentator on television?
No, yeah. I'm not saying I watched it or heard it. I'm just saying
you heard about it.
People have told me
you were listening to Mick. I'm sure.
That the commentator on television was saying, you know, I don't understand. They keep throwing the ball to Olsen. A couple of the other players keep getting repeating some of the same moves over and over. It's clear coming into this game that these are the players that Cam uses all the time, and they are not protecting them at all. They're not blocking them. It's like they're not even on the field. What's up with that? Well, you say they other teams know, but do they know?
I think in a crazy kind of a way that Kelvin Benjamin's injury has enhanced Cam Newton's development as a diagnostician of coverages. Because in Cam's career, he's had, for the most part, he's had Greg Olsen, a favorite target, but he's had Steve Smith, that sometimes when Smitty was playing, even if he wasn't open, he was the best option. Mm-hmm. Kelvin Benjamin, such an eye-catching player, the big catch radius, the ability to make plays, acrobatic catches, particularly in the red zone, if he's not open, he still might be the best option. That's not true this year. So Cam Newton has had to look at it from a different filter. He's had to run it through the filter of, okay, here's my primary, here's my secondary, here's the third option. Whether it's Brenton Burson, Philly Brown, Ted Ginn, Devin Funchess, Greg Olsen, he's had to look at it through more of a coverage standpoint. And I think you wouldn't want to go through it again. They'll be glad to get Benjamin back, but I think it's helped Cam Newton.
And is that the big secret here? The secret sauce is that Cam Newton has matured as a quarterback?
I would agree with that, yeah. But I remember Ron Rivera's very first year, Mike, I was talking to him. I said, what percentage is quarterback play in the NFL? What percentage is it? And that's a question most coaches will duck, but this is one of the first times I got a dose of Ron Rivera's honesty. He thinks about it a while and he goes, I believe it's about 55%. The quarterback position is 55%, which is a really exact number. But so Cam Newton, that's more than half the team, right? So Cam Newton is playing, I'd say, two levels better than he ever has before. So that 55% has moved up to an A-plus range.
How much of that is experience? How much of that is confidence? How much of that is coaching?
Probably equal parts. Mike does this, you know, Scott. He asks you these tricky little hypothetical questions.
He's looking for a 55%.
Get you out on thin ice. But think about it this way, fellas. I mean, I was talking to some buddies of mine the other day, and sort of the whole Cam Newton phenomenon has just descended onto my head like a big weight, and it just occurred to me, we're watching a one-off, minted, stamped, dyed original. Where else in the history of the league, not just in Carolina Panther history, but when else has there been a quarterback that commingled his talent, his ability to run, pass, and his size and athleticism?
Steve McNair would be the closest, probably, but it's not at this level, not at this long.
We'll take a further look at all this in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet's Nutcracker, a holiday tradition with over 100 dancers and the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra, December 10th through the 23rd at Belk Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.org. And Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region, a North Carolina experienced hospice provider offering end-of-life care since 1978. More information at 704-375-0100. The hunt continues for those behind the Paris attacks as a growing number of regional and world powers agree on the need to unite against ISIS. In 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Diane and her guests talk about the prospects for an international coalition and the strategies on the table. That's at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation about the Panthers, now's your shot. Search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org.
We're coming. We have a day to give thanks. We have 2 days for shopping deals. And now there's a day to give back. Tuesday, December 1st is Giving Tuesday, a day to celebrate the charitable organizations that are making a difference in our shared community. This Giving Tuesday, please consider making a contribution to support WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. No matter which charity you support this Giving Tuesday, know how thankful we all are for your support of our community.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Panthers with the radio voice of the Carolina Panthers from the Carolina Panthers Radio Network, Mick Mixon and Scott Fowler, sports writer and columnist for the Charlotte Observer. So far in the regular season, we beat the Jaguars 20-9, the Texans 24-17, the Saints 27-22, the Buccaneers 37-23, upset the Seahawks in Seattle 27-23, beat the Eagles 27-16, the Colts 29-26, the Green Bay Packers by a whopping 37-29, and the Titans last Sunday 27-10. How tough a schedule has that been? And of those teams, who was the best? Who really put us to the test?
I would say the turning point of that group, in my opinion, Mike, was the win at Seattle, a team the Panthers had struggled with and lost to over and over and over. This was Charlie Brown trying to kick the football from Lucy, and it was so often they came close and didn't get there. And then suddenly in Seattle it happened, and that's when I sort of believed already, but I guess when I saw that, I was like, oh, my gosh, this is a really good team. This may be the best team I've ever covered.
The Philadelphia game, too, stands out. I remember a Mike Tolbert run where the Panthers have it in the red zone, knocking on the door. I think the ball was at the 2-yard line, and Cam Newton throws a pass to Mike Tolbert in the right flat. Tolbert gets hit, knocked back to the 6-yard line, and then out fights 4 different Eagle tacklers to the right pylon for a touchdown. And I thought, I got chills right now even thinking about that play, because I thought there's a lot of examples, but that play emblematic of the fighting spirit on this Carolina Panther team.
In some of these games, in many of these games, we kind of fade in the middle. And that makes it for an exciting finish, I suppose, a heart-thumping, nail-biting finish, because you were either coming from behind or they could just catch up at the last second and kill us, and we come out on top nonetheless. But what's happening in the middle?
That's part of a listenership initiative through the Carolina Panthers Radio Network, where to get the sponsors more total gross impressions. We've asked the team to just keep the other team's world propped up just enough,
so that you can add extra commercials at the end of the game.
And overtime would be good.
Overtime.
Not every week.
That's right, yeah. What's happening in the middle of the game?
Well, I don't think the Panthers' margin for error is really that huge. They're not 10 times better than everyone else. They have, like Mick was saying, they probably got 8 or 10 players that anyone in the NFL would love to have. And then they've got a lot of guys who are kind of okay. And so sometimes the other team, as John Fox used to say, the other team gets paid too. Sometimes the other team's just better for a while. But these guys have more versatility, I think, than I've ever seen
before.
Well,
let's talk about that, because we talked about Cam, and he is the star. There's no question. But there are other stars on the team.
Right. Luke Kuechly is, if Cam's 1, Luke Kuechly is 1A, and those are the two guys that this whole team is built around.
What about Greg Olsen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but you know, I think Olsen, Josh Norman, K.K. Short, who's a defensive tackle, Ryan Khalil, who's a center, they probably have a half dozen guys who are playing at a Pro Bowl level
Thomas Davis.
Thomas Davis, absolutely.
One NFL commentator says that the Panthers are a team of contributors, kind of like Bill Belichick's first Super Bowl team, the 2001 Patriots. Another commentator says that's why we're winning. We've congealed as a team with everybody pulling their own weight and then some. Is that how you see it?
That makes sense. I think that to Scott's point earlier in your question, Mike, about the Panthers maybe seeming to fade in the middle or to let teams back in it, I really think part of this process has been the Panthers learning how to handle high expectations, learning how to handle being the favorite or having the lead. The Panthers are a proven commodity over the last several years prior to this year of knowing how to handle adversity, but success brings with it a different set of expectations.
Last year, and I know this because we did a number on it in Charlotte Squawks, but last year we seemed to have trouble blocking. That doesn't seem to be the case this year. How do we turn that around?
Well, they got their offensive line, I think, is one of the hidden components of why this team's so good. They've got the guy from The Blind Side. If you've ever seen the movie, he plays left tackle for him, Michael Oher, and he's just playing better than the guy who used to play that position. That's part of it. Then they've got some young guys. No one knows their names other than Panther junkies like Mick and myself, and they're better. And then they've got a guy in the middle, Ryan Khalil, who kind of puts it all together. But, yes, they do block better, they run better. They do a lot of these fundamental things that aren't that flashy, and then they got one guy who provides all the flash for everybody else.
Give me talk about what's your impression of the contribution being made by Mike Shula, the offensive coordinator?
I talked to his dad the other day, Don Shula, and Don Shula, of course, was the author of The Only Perfect Season Ever. So he's cheering for the Panthers from Miami. That's Mike's father. I think Mike kind of gets a bad rap. People think he's too conservative. People think he's, I don't know. They've got a lot – offensive coordinators are often unpopular. To me, Mike Shula is calm and does about what he – as well as he could with what he's got.
I think his reputation as a – I don't know what his reputation is as a play caller, because I'm not out on social media and I don't generally participate in those kind of things. Like, Scott's pretty in touch with who's tweeting this and who's chat room and blogging that. But just looking at it for I think what it is, Mike Shula, he's not scared. He's not afraid as a play caller. I really love the fact that he dials into different kinds of rhythms during games. Talks to Cam a lot, and it's not just Mike Shula saying, okay, this week here's what we're going to run. He'll go to Cam Newton and say, and to Greg Olsen and Ryan Khalil and say, what do you guys think? What do you like? So it's you got coaches coaching players, players helping coach each other, and then players helping coach coaches on how to coach them. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's all part of why the Panthers get on so well.
Many people have written, don't start talking about an undefeated season. Don't get too far ahead of yourself.
That's not going to happen anyway. They are not going to go undefeated.
They're not?
No.
How can you say that? Probability is with you, but that cannot be known.
It's true, but an undefeated season would have to be 19-0, and given that it's never happened but once in 95 years, I feel pretty confident
and
it won't happen.
It was Don Shula's team, wasn't
it? It was, 1972.
Well, maybe that's
now. I'm not saying they won't win the Super Bowl. Now, there's much better odds of that.
Well, now, wait a minute. The other 9-0 team is the New England Patriots.
Right.
We played them in the preseason and lost by a point. So if we face them in the Super Bowl, what is the likelihood of turning that around?
Well, it's gambler's ruin. The coin does not know that it has just come up heads 10 times in a row. So
Right. Preseason
games are so different. But I think that you don't have to win these nine. You don't have to go back and win those over again. You've already done that. So
True.
I think the one thing the Panthers have done such a great job of, and I know Scott would agree with this, and Mike, you too probably, is that the Panthers have done a fantastic job of insulating themselves from all of that kind of talk. Ron Rivera is insistent that the Panthers look only at their hood ornament, only at the road ahead, mm-hmm. to make sure that they're in their lane, concentrating on the next mile that needs to be driven.
The road ahead is the Redskins. They're coming here on Sunday. They used to be the South's team before the Panthers and the Falcons came on. We beat the Saints by 5 points. The Redskins beat them last Sunday 47-14, which has to give them some confidence coming in here. They're now 4-5 on the season. What does that portend for us?
Well, the Redskins can get hot, and offensively, I know that the Panthers are concerned. I wouldn't say scared, because they're not scared of anybody these days, and then certainly the Panthers will be favored. But like any game, Mick, I mean, if they play badly, if the Panthers lay an egg in any of these last seven, they're going to lose. I mean, Kirk Cousins is playing with a lot of confidence. That's their quarterback. But I mean, I think the Panthers will win this one. I don't think this will be as difficult as, say, playing Atlanta twice or the New York Giants at New York later in the season. I think the Panthers will get this one.
And I mentioned that the Redskins were the South's team for so long because they still have fans here, and they'll be in the stands on Sunday.
Yeah.
There'll be some. That culture is changing, though, I think. The Panthers travel. I mean, it was unbelievable at Tennessee. To mm-hmm. hear when the mm-hmm. Panthers would make a good play, there's an audible roar that comes up from the stands. There were Panther fans at Seattle that had either made the trip or there are Panther fans who live out there, and we're seeing the same thing different cities that we go to. So just remember that dude outside the stadium on Sunday in a Sonny Jurgensen jersey or a Billy Kilmer jersey, he's not your friend.
Yes.
Share with him your sweet tea, your deviled eggs, your barbecue, a little piece of chicken, but not tickets.
And mention Len Hathaway's name. Okay, now, he used to be the voice of the Redskins on the radio. We both knew him, Mick and I. The Cowboys follow the Redskins. They're having a losing season. Are they a concern beyond every team being a concern for us?
Yeah, I think that's a threat, don't you, Mick? I mean, is Romo going to be back for that
Looks
game?
Looks that way, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, they get their quarterback back. They're probably 30% better. And, you know, that game's in Dallas, and they always usually play well. It's on Thanksgiving Day. Another testament to the Panthers' growing popularity, they're playing their first ever Thanksgiving Day game this year.
Yeah.
Never done that before.
Yeah, and I guess with Romo being back, the crowd will be excited in Dallas.
Yep. Yep, the crowd will be excited. But, you know, getting to Mick's point on first-generation Panthers fans, I've got two boys who are 17 and 14. They have never not had a Panthers team here. So they don't remember anything other than the Panthers. And there's a lot of kids at that level or kids who are in college now or whatever. And so, the Panther fan base does grow stronger. I was honestly stunned at how many fans were in Tennessee, according to everyone there. And when you go down to Atlanta, there's a ton of Panther fans. So it's changing, and this is becoming a better home environment. I don't think as many tickets will be sold to what Redskins fans this year.
After Dallas, we get another crack at the Saints. Will this be payback time?
I have no idea because we got to take our games one at a time, give 110%, take what the defense gives us, and other cliches thereunto appertaining. But the Saints' defense is a problem, Mike. They changed. Scott and I were talking out in the lobby when you were talking to the body people about how the Saints have fired their D coordinator, Rob Ryan, to try to get some discipline, get some fundamentals back in their D. They have some good people, and anytime Drew Brees is the trigger man, they are kind of scary. So that'll be a tough one.
Yeah, that'll be a tough one.
All things being equal, as you head deeper into a season and certain players emerge as your key players, and the other teams take notice of that, and you run certain plays, and they're successful or not successful. But do you become more predictable? Is it harder to play against the other team because they've seen your bag of tricks?
Well, that's true for both sides,
though. Yeah.
You know, you think, well, predictability, yes. I mean, people know what LeBron James is going to do when he goes on the court. They've seen it for 10 years. It's very hard to stop. Same thing with Cam Newton. They know that he likes to run the ball and he likes to throw the ball, and there are certain places he likes to go with it. It's very hard to stop. And that's the same way with other teams. I mean, they've seen Drew Brees for years, and he's lit them up for years for the most part.
We play the Falcons twice in December.
3 weeks.
This is like an arch rivalry. We play them. We have a week off from not playing them. We play them again. What special problems does that present?
The greatly detested Atlanta Falcons, two times in 3 weeks. The familiarity component of it, I think, is legit. But as Scott said, both teams will have to deal with it. So teams will kind of want to do some self-scouting and counter their own tendencies. Dan Quinn is the new coach. He made his bones in Seattle, coordinating some of the most aggressive, talented defenses that the NFL has ever seen in the modern era. And Atlanta, the first thing he wanted them to do is get better running the ball and get better on D, and they've done both of those things. They're much more like the Carolina Panthers. So this will be sort of like looking into a mirror in a way, don't you think, Scott, those two games?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that's going to be tough.
Let me bring in some comments that people have been making, listeners have been making as we've been talking here. Everett on Facebook, Dick Butkus was just in Charlotte criticizing Cam for not playing with class. Mr. Butkus was a dirty player who was known for biting and spitting on people. Where is all the hate coming from? Interesting he says that because FoxSports.com wrote an article about the Panthers this week, and this is the first sentence. The Carolina Panthers have been the class of not only the NFC South, but of the NFC as a whole. And they point to Cam Newton as being part of that class. What's up with that?
Well, that's old school versus new school, don't you think, Mick? I mean, this is a sort of like this letter we ran in the Charlotte Observer this week that went viral all over the place, the Tennessee mom criticizing Cam Newton for his various tactics after his celebrations.
Spend 30 seconds talking about that.
Yeah,
because he's confiscated the sign. That's resulted in a new policy in the stadium.
Yep, yep.
And then he does this dance in the end zone, and Tennessee got pretty upset with it toward the end of the game last year.
They did. I wrote a column in the Charlotte Observer basically saying what Cam's doing out there celebrating is just fine. I think it's just fine. I think ultimately what he does is not taunting people. He's never been penalized for it. Yes, you may not like it, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
He's not out there doing crotch-grabbing, throat-slashing gang signals. He's having a good time. He's exuberant. He's effervescent. Haters are always going to hate. They hated Cassius Marcellus Clay, later Muhammad Ali, because he was too braggadocious. They hated Jack Nicklaus because he was Arnold Palmer's foil. But if you're good enough and classy enough for long enough, they come around.
So Dennis wants to know, will there be dabbing on Sunday?
Oh, I think there is no way there won't be, I think, or at least not dabbing to Superman, something. He will do something. He is not going to let people change him. I mean, he is, as he said yesterday in sort of a Popeye rendition, he said, I am who I am.
Kim on Facebook writes, Charlotte is becoming a football town. This team, Rivera and Cam, feel like our team for the first time in a long time.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
But
One of the commentators on television last Sunday mentioned that Cam wants his team to revel in their 8-0 season. He wants, that was 8-0 then, but when he was talking about it, now they're 9-0. He wants them to remember their time on this team, this year's team. He wants them to remember this year. Is that something to be said about that as a motivator?
Daggum right. I love the banner thing against Green Bay, guys, because that was Cam Newton demonstrating that he's not just a mercenary. He's not just throwing passes here because he's paid to do so. He, of course, is paid. But this is his town. These are his teammates. This is his stadium, and those are his fans. And when he acts like it, like that, like he's always done throughout his career, it's phenomenal.
If the winning stops on this Sunday or any Sunday in the future, should we still be happy?
Oh, yeah. As I've written a few times, you got to be really happy the next. Panther fans, I'm talking to you out there. You got to be really happy because this is for the next 2 months. It doesn't matter if they win or lose. They're going to make the playoffs.
Look up Scott Fowler's story on Ray Carruth's son, Chancellor Lee Adams, which appeared in the Sunday paper. It's real worth reading and something we should have talked about this morning. We just didn't have time. Thanks to Scott. Thanks to Mick Mixon, the voice of the Panthers.